what brings you to this workshop? As short term as what happened in the plenary just now, or this morning, or a workshop you attended, or last night's presentation, or things that have been happening in your whole life, what brings you to this particular workshop today?
I love hearing real talk about actual things that are going on in our world right now from the pulpit. And it's, I find, unusual. I was inspired by your plenary yesterday.
Oh, amen. Thank you.
In the write-up to the description of the workshop was the word dualism, which we feel we are embedded in. So I thought there might be something that would touch on that.
Yeah. Very good.
And maybe the opposite, or the, not the opposite, but another piece, not dualism.
Right.
The Catholic Worker Movement brought me to kind of an understanding of what imperialism is and the effects of that a few years ago. And when I first learned about it, the effect was kind of shock and then sorrow. And I wore like black tunic for 2 years to like grieve the wars. And then I said I would do that until I could find some way to resist that, and ended up organizing. But just, I feel like I never really took the time to process how imperialism has oppressed me. And I have a really good friend who was like challenging me to think about that. Like, why are you doing organizing outside of your community? Like, your own community is oppressed, and that's where you should be working. And I've gotten that message a lot from people in other communities where I've been working. They're like, thank you for your advocacy, but go back where you came from. Because that's one of the roots of the problem that you can speak to if you can't. Yeah, so looking for ways to learn about that and ways to articulate it, and ways to undo the oppression in myself, and then communicate that in loving ways to people in my family and my Christian community who don't see it yet.
Anyone else want to share about why you're here at this particular workshop? Yes, JD.
I will. It says something about imperial.
Imperial brokenness?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I've known Jim there for a few years now. And each time I hear him speak, it's like I just get this unexplainable guilt. And so yesterday I went to the sacred site on the sacred site tour. And after he was done with his presentation, he asked each of us to take a walk through the woods and listen to the Holy Spirit and allow God to speak to us. And when I was walking out there on the sacred site, I kept saying, God, I don't know how white people feel when they listen to Native Americans speak, but my heart is so broken I can hardly take it. So Jim Bear just came to me today because he knows I feel this way. And he said, we both came from...
That was my suggestion earlier.
Are some people willing or able to sit on the floor? Is it that?
Yes.
Or
there's a seat over here. Somebody could take.
Maybe you guys shift back and then maybe you
is going outside too much work even?
They want to record this, and it's yeah. That's the only thing, and probably hard to hear too. So we'll try to make the best of it. There's a seat here now. If someone wants to come this way. someone please sit right here? Okay.
Somebody sit in the chairs.
And there's a seat right there.
It's always all women that sit on the phone. I have to recognize that dynamic.
Sorry, JD, please proceed.
Okay, so as I was saying, I feel this incredible grief and pain. And when our sister was just speaking about, you know, the walk in the waterways and that it's like my heart became so broken I had to get up and leave the room.
Mm.
And so when I came back at the end of the session, Jim Bear came to me and he started to talk about the fundamental background that we both came from. He was Assemblies of God. I was Church of God, which means we grew up in these white institutions. I mean, we came to know Christ in these white institutional
mm-hmm.
churches.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, so JD, think of it like this. It is not you taking on my pain or my grief or from my experience. But when you grow up in a fundamental church, even though with all of the faults of the institutional white church, Jesus is there.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, think about the pain that Jesus must feel. And that's what you're sharing in, the mm-hmm. grief that Jesus feel over that. And it was just, I was like, I wrote my thesis on church and race and how to have a conversation. I said, you should have been my thesis advisor.
Mm.
I feel like I need to redo my thesis because that was just so enlightening for me.
Mm.
So that's why I'm here. I just want to hear more about how I can walk into this freedom that Jesus is calling me.
Thank you, JD. It's deep.
I came down here to just sit and learn. I like the title of Thursday night's talk, something about radical something. And I thought, and I told you this when I was talking at the, I thought, yeah, I think I like that. Not that I'm a radical guy or anything, but then I felt a little nudge from the Holy Spirit saying, why don't you do something radical? And you don't really want to be doing what you're doing, even though you love it. You want to be doing this other thing. Why don't you decide, make a decision here? And so I've been spending the last 4 or 5 days, since Wednesday, rearranging a few things I was going to do, and so now I'm going to do that. But then when I got here, then I realized it was like when I was here last year at the Doctrine of Discovery that I was, this is where I was supposed to be at this time right now. So I like what you said on, I don't remember if it was the first night or if it was last night. I don't even know what day it is now.
Last night.
Last night when you said that it isn't only white people. I like your explanation of that. It isn't only white people who have the benefits of white privilege. And, you know, I did a quick inventory of my life. I have an MBA. I'm one of the imperialists. I teach business, finance, and marketing. And I do all that. You know, I thought, I got to listen a little bit more here to what's going on. And not that I hadn't been up to that, but so I came here because I like the title of this. I'm saying again, I like the dualism part of it. But the other part, you know, and then when you ask the question, you get to do it. You'd say, you know, one of the most difficult parts for me is as an Indian person is probably has nothing to do with this workshop, but you know, just maybe it goes along with what this lady just said. I'm so tired of people coming up to me and apologizing to me. I'm so tired of that.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised in Catholic Church, but I did the whole born-again thing here a few years back. And I understood and I bought into and I really loved the part I like about what I do now is forgiveness. That's what I like. So I just like for the first time in my life to publicly apologize to all of you for what I thought of you
over my 64 years on this earth, the anger and the resentment and the racist thoughts and all of that kind of stuff, I want my time now to be able to say, I'm sorry to you. You know, and I ask your forgiveness. And, you know, having said that, I just feel like a whole big, huge load is gone. And it just, it makes me so much better. Please don't apologize to me. You don't owe me any apology whatsoever. Do whatever the hell it is you've got to do to make yourself feel okay, but certainly don't make that apologizing to me.
I'm sorry for apologizing before.
And I looked around before I said it. No one in here has.
Okay.
Nobody in here has. But if you ever feel that you'll get that out of this as we go through and finish up the weekend, don't do that.
Yeah.
Don't do that. Just, we're sick of it. So,
All right. Thank you. I'll just share a little bit about what I mean by imperial brokenness so we can share some stories about communal healing. When things break because they don't work, but things also break because there's no bend. And empire is that which cannot bend, right? Because it's got a mission. Empire is a mission-oriented enterprise. So that's a pretty dangerous thing, in my opinion. So mission, missional, missionary, mission-minded. I mean, like, we even say, what's the mission? Now even businesses have mission statements. You know that? And of course, churches and nonprofits have been on this bandwagon for a long time. And some families have designed mission statements for themselves. There's even personal mission statements. Well, maybe to have some purpose and meaning is a good thing. But I'm just afraid that mission means we're kind of on this path that cannot bend. And then, because life is life, and life is not always neat or orderly, contrary to what Presbyterians like to believe, things will break. And maybe it didn't need to break, but if we're on a mission, it's going to break. So the mission of empire is to organize geography and resources and people to bring glory to a few human beings at the expense of others. That's always been the mission of empire. And those of us who serve imperial interests pretty well also get a few crumbs of imperial privilege, right? And that happens to be what we call white people in North America, but we're all pretty much slaves, at best low-level administrators of this imperial system. So we're all being exploited, we're all being had, we're all being played, but then the conflict is low-level people like us fighting it out with each other for these crumbs. So, man, we are truly the damned. And I mean that, it seems like the justice work that I've seen, that I've been a part of too for a long time, is kind of redistributing the crumbs better, right? And that just seems primarily to be our work, and what I roughly call liberalism, and, you know, evangelical liberalism now, and all kinds of stuff, but it's just not enough. And yes, but I mean, it is important work, because some of us need those crumbs to eat. Like, some of us really need to eat that day. So I don't want to be too dismissive. We need to eat. We need to have housing tonight, and especially in Minnesota when it gets so cold, to redistribute some of these crumbs, like food and housing and clothing and a little bit of education and training, is not a small thing. So please don't hear me being dismissive about our daily bread. That is our prayer, after all. But long term, I mean, this is, what are we doing? We're just spinning our wheels long term. So some of us have to swim upstream to figure out who is polluting the headwaters. And so much of our justice work, our faith-based organizing work, so much of our activism and resistance is dealing with the pollution at the bottom of the watershed. So there are a few people controlling all this stuff at the top, and they poison the stuff not only with actual physical pollution, but with ideological confusion, right? Like, we don't even know who our enemies are. There are a whole bunch of poor white people who think the enemy is black people and Mexican immigrants. Can you believe that? This is the kind of ideological. Oh, yes. Blue-collar unions, working class, yeah. And liberals, and white liberals, and, you know, and progressive millennials or whoever. I mean, like, there's, it's unbelievable how many people out there are duped into thinking that people that are struggling and are oppressed are actually our enemies. We have no idea who our friends and who our enemies are. So this is the brilliant system that we've created. The difference between conventional warfare and guerrilla warfare is that in conventional warfare, you know who your enemies are. You have borders, and they're on that side, and we're on this side, and they wear that uniform, and we wear this uniform, right? But in guerrilla warfare, you dress like your enemies. You're behind the lines, and you could come in out of anywhere. And that's why it's so, it can be so brutal, because it, when you're dressed like civilians, you might go overboard. And that's much of what we saw in Vietnam and in many conflicts around the world. I think the elite, those at the top, and they do happen to be white, The white elites, like the what some have called the 1%, are waging guerrilla warfare. They are behind enemy lines, and they masquerade as us. And they basically said, us white people, right? And they have been gracious, it's in quotes, gracious in extending whiteness to anybody who will be part of the mission of extending neoliberal politics and economics all over the world, where most of the resources rise to the top. So you're Asian, you're Latino, you're African-American or Native or whatever, and you participate in this, then you're white, right? There are non-white people in the Tea Party movement, for instance.
Thank you so much.
It's good to be the senior pastor.
I'd say so.
To paraphrase Mel Brooks from History of the World, Part 1. Yes. Well, we get our hermeneutical insight from Mel Brooks here at Church of All Nations. It's like a Jewish rabbi with a sense of humor. And it's so single-minded in its desire, our neoliberal empire as embodied in America. It is so single-minded in its need to exploit everything for the benefit of a few, that any of us that participate in this rigid mission are going to break. Because that's just not how human beings were made. I mean, like, we're talking about watershed. 3/4 of our body is water, isn't it? This is a watershed right here. And how much of this water that we're full of do we harden in order to participate in the rigid mission of empire? And of course, our minds and our bodies and all of our organs are going to just come to a screeching halt, which we just can't handle it. And all of us bear the symptoms of imperial brokenness, but as I alluded to last night, in my pastoral ministry, it's our white members who are most deeply embedded in the mission of empire and have been for generations, and thus they embody the illness and the brokenness more fully and deeply than any other group of people in our church. Our church has over 25 nations represented here. And I see it at the molecular level. So I see our non-white members as bearing the symptoms of empire. There is brokenness there too. But our white members embody empire. Like the logic of empire is encoded in the bodies of our white members. And it's really, really heartbreaking, disturbing, horrifying. And I think about the ministry that I do, where we call upon God, and I believe in the miraculous power of God. And I'm just, but I wonder though, this embeddedness, this embodiedness of empire is so like almost at the DNA level with our white members. I wonder if God has the power to heal us at that molecular level. I say that in despair sometimes, but in my heart of hearts, I do believe that God has that power. And I believe that God has given that kind of healing power to God's good creation. And these water walks and connecting to the watershed in the environment and the watershed within us and reconnecting with water is a critical part of that healing. But the West doesn't have, I don't think, any resources to get us there. Because water is seen as female, and there is such misogyny in Western philosophy and Western civilization. There's not a respect for the female. So we in the West like Earth, because you can organize Earth into concrete and bricks. And we try to do everything we can to defend ourselves from water, right? Keep the water out. When China was going through its warring states period about 2,500 years ago, Confucius was an early political scientist, much like Machiavelli, you know, a couple thousand years later in the West. And he tried to advise some of the warlords how to run an effective empire, right? So that's what Confucianism is. And about 100, maybe 100 to 200 years later, there may have actually been a person named Lao Tzu, or there may have been a school organized under this mythical person's name. But the school of Lao Tzu came up with Taoism as a response to imperial Confucianism, and said, we need to take water seriously, air seriously, the earth, nature seriously, and see how things are rigid at times and bend at other times. And that water, even though it is the most malleable thing in the world, ultimately has its way. Nothing can stand in the way of water. I mean, look at the Grand Canyon. That's all done by water. As we've seen some of the maps that Chet showed this morning, ultimately, in the long run, nothing is more powerful than water. How do we go with water than against it, right? Was a fundamental question that that Taoism asked. So philosophically, also, we've got to return to water. It's not just the physical watershed. We have to understand the idea of water, what water represents. And if we go the way of water, perhaps we can heal. The earth has amazing regenerative and healing powers if we leave it alone, right? I remember visiting some towns in Russia that after the fall of communism, they no longer needed like this whole factory town. And I could not believe that within 12 to 15 years, and when the town was abandoned, you could hardly see where the concrete was anymore. I mean, trees had gone right through the concrete. There were things growing through buildings. And I could just tell that within, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, there will hardly be any trace of human habitation there. That's how powerful nature is. Well, we can, like, create all kinds of things. But given enough time, things will heal. I wonder if that's how we heal from imperial brokenness, right? Not surgery, which is our preferred way. Something quick and immediate and very invasive, and sometimes that's necessary. But imperial brokenness, which is just, you know, putting something on top of by fiat, you know, that healing from that requires many, many years, decades, of just allowing us to grow and change and shift naturally. I'll just share a little bit now about our church. I'm so embarrassingly conventional. Probably everybody here has been part of the radical movement longer than I have. So really, I feel embarrassed and I feel honored that you are here to listen to anything I have to say. I have so much to learn from you, and there's a lot of wisdom here in your bodies, in your experiences. So I want to honor you and thank you for being here and in some ways humoring me. How we started Church of All Nations is like the thing that Korean people had was family and clan and ethnos. We didn't have much else in our 5,000 year history. One historian said about our people a number of years ago, the singular achievement of the Korean people is that we are still here. If you know anything about the history of Asia, you will understand the profundity of that statement. We're Mongolians, I think, who got lost and kind of got separated from the bigger tribe. I like to call Korean people the Hikawi people. Like, we got to the Peninsula and said, "Where are the Hikawi?" Okay. That's an old joke from a show called F Troop, if anybody knows what that is. Okay, yeah. And so we're ethnically distinct than the majority of the Chinese, who are Han Chinese. We're more descended from the Mongols. And then the Japanese are people that left the Korean Peninsula and mixed with the Ainu people, the indigenous people there. So they look a little bit different than us, but they actually, Japanese people look closer to us than the Chinese because of our common roots. And so we're just kind of stuck on this peninsula for thousands of years, and the Chinese mostly decided that it was more profitable to wring tribute out of us than to actually occupy us. It is expensive in ancient days and to this day to actually occupy and run a country. If they have their own leaders, and you just get them to do their thing, but they send tribute, you know, it's more efficient. That was Persia's strategy, and that's why Persia allowed the rebuilding of the temple and the city walls of Jerusalem and all that. So because of that, we've been able to maintain our own language and music and culture for thousands of years. It's the Japanese that have tried to actually physically colonize us for at least 1,400, 1,500 years. And so China has been a convenient patron as a bulwark against Japanese aggression. So the one thing that Korean people have had to rely on is deep family bond, communal bond. We have this concept on the one hand called Han, not like Han Chinese, a different Han. Han meaning suffering. And it's when you really get to understand the concept of Han in the Korean context, It's like historical suffering. And when Korean people weep sometimes, like, it might be triggered by the death of someone or some tragedy. But when a Korean person weeps in a certain way, they're weeping for thousands of years of suffering of our people. That's Han. And Korean people who are rooted in our story know what that is and feel it in their body and can weep at that level. And I worry about myself, if I have that capacity, I worry about my children, third generation Korean Americans now, if they will have Han in their bones. It's a gift, it's a treasure. It's a cultural treasure that we have to be able to weep historically. But we also have this thing called Jung. I would spell it like J-U-N-G. And Jung is the Hebrew word chesed. It kind of means faithfulness and loyalty, but it means so many things. Jung means, first of all, affection, but it also means loyalty, and it means intimacy and advocacy and love and attachment. So Korean people also have this Jung for each other. But because of thousands of years of imperial oppression around us, we're also very ethnocentric, right? And fearful of outsiders. So the good thing about Korean people is that we have Jung, a lot of Jung. But the bad thing is that it can easily break among us because of jealousy and fear, and we don't extend it outside the Korean tribe. So Church of All Nations, software-wise, was asking the question, what if we were to kind of keep the negative parts of historic Korean culture out of it, and especially take Korean Jung and extend it in a multicultural way? What would a church look like, right, that was full of this ancient Korean concept of Jung applied to everyone, open to everyone? So this sense of intimacy and family is at the heart of our ethos. In fact, that's really everything. If we don't have that, we would disband right away. So it's not activism, it's not analysis, it's not, radical discipleship, as much as important as that is. That's who we were or even who we are now. It's just family and kinship. And this is why native spirituality is so congruent with who we are, because much of native spirituality is about understanding all of us as being part of a kinship and extending that kinship to the whole universe. So that's what we mean by a multicultural church. It's being family with all of God's creation. But then that means that we care about each other's lives and our backgrounds and each other's brokenness. But how are we broken? Why are we broken? I mean, we can go back to a particular event. And by the way, it's amazing to me. Here's the difference, if I may say, just as a little aside, between when I counsel our white members and our non-white members. When I ask our white members the sources of their brokenness, well, let me start with the other members. When I ask our non-white members, like especially our immigrants, the source of their brokenness, it's something external to them. You know, their parents got divorced when they were little, or the trauma of immigration, or they were bullied, or they had a severe accident, or they were raped or something. Horrible things happen to people. But when I ask our white members the source of their hurt and brokenness, they actually take responsibility. Well, I did this, and I thought this, and I made this decision. And I am thinking, wait, but this happened when you were five. You made a decision at the age of five that led to your own brokenness? I mean, like, that is just not possible in my mind, right? But this dogma of individualism is so powerful, this personal responsibility, giving choices. And I see that with our white parents, where at the earliest age, they'll say, do you want a blue sippy cup or a green sippy cup? At the age of, like, two, do you want this? I mean, like, no matter how trivial, there's this fear that that a person will grow up to be dependent, God forbid, on other human beings. Like, that's the worst sin in the world, to be dependent on other human beings. So we inculcate in our children at the earliest age this notion that they have to be independent, but all we're doing is just giving them separation anxiety. Generation after generation of separation anxiety in this quest to make it in this cold, cruel, hard empire in which you have to be independent, right? Because empire divides and conquers. We know that. So we train our children at the earliest age to prepare for that division and conquering by getting them to be autonomous units in an imperial order. So the first thing I have to say to the people that I counsel is, first of all, it's not your fault. Your brokenness does not originate with you. That may be obvious to some people here, especially if we've done some therapeutic work ourselves, but it is, for some of our members, a revolutionary realization that their brokenness does not originate with them. There's nothing wrong with you. There never was anything wrong with you from the beginning. It was your parents, but it didn't originate with them either. It was because it was their parents and their parents. And it's the society that decided to abandon the native ways, the natural flow of water within their body and in their watershed to move to earth moving, earth building, earth reorganization, skyscrapers, Babel, all of that. Because we bought the lie that when we build the Tower of Babel, all of us will live in the skyscraper, right? No, only a few live in Babel, and the rest of us are slaves forever. And countless people have bought that lie. Some wittingly, some unwittingly, some have been incorporated into it by force. So unraveling the roots of our brokenness is one of the most critical things we do here. And just to tell everybody, our brokenness is not our fault. Our brokenness is not our responsibility. We didn't cause it. But our healing is our responsibility, right? Our healing is our responsibility, but our brokenness is not our fault. And just starting there, and to recognize that we are victims of this imperial rigidity, imperial hardness, and that we're all being crushed by this rigidity, we're all being dehumanized because we're not allowed to be the fluid water that we are, is where we start. But then how does one heal, right? And this is where the Korean concept of Chung comes in, where we just see each other not as the haves and have-nots, not as white people and black people and, you know, Asian immigrants and whatever, but just as broken people, broken bodies. So that's what we all are. If we have eyes to see each other through the lens of empire, we see we have all, to some degree, been broken by empire. And then we have compassion for one another, real compassion. From that lens, as I said last night, our white members are more broken because they've been more colonized by empire than others. And we just reach out to one another and share what we have. Material resources are important. A church community, an intimate church community, allows for sharing of material resources. But there's emotional resources, there's social resources, there's intellectual resources, there's relational resources, and different groups have different strengths and different weaknesses. And to be a congregation means living out 1 Corinthians chapter 12, right? The body is made up of many parts. And no part of the body says to another, I have no need of you. But it's easy for the head to act all supremacist over the feet, right? Paul recognized that. But the feet need the head, and the head needs the feet. So as long as we come together with mutual need, and mutual grace and mutual appreciation, then it's okay to be whatever we are. And we should be proud of the strengths that we bring. And there are strengths in every single person here and every cultural background. that we come from. And then what are the practices? We just have to be together a lot. Like if you worship with us this Sunday morning, Chet will be preaching, by the way, you'll see that we do an exchange of peace like many liturgical churches. We're kind of a liturgical Presbyterian church, loosely. We have a confession of sin, declaration of pardon, and then exchange of peace. Everybody know that routine? But our exchange of peace lasts about 5 minutes. And I have our pianist Sugi play the African-American spiritual Amen on the piano. And then everybody's in the center aisle, and we just go around hugging each other, like real hugs. Sometimes an occasional Minnesota sideway hug, but usually a full-bodied hug. And people are really, really glad to see each other. There's a little bit of a downside to it. Like visitors for the first time who are not used to that can often just kind of stand in the pew and be paralyzed, you know, for a good long 5 minutes. And sometimes they never come back because of that. But our new members, they almost always say that is the reason that they joined. Because they see that it's real and that we want to be together. And a lot of people think that that is a more important time than the preaching. And I don't know how I'm going to convince them otherwise, but but there are people who join really because of that. And then we have a communal meal. The kind of meals that we've had at this conference is what Hikari does every Sunday. She considers it her ministry to the church. And so she gets a team of people to cook for the church, and then people contribute what they can. It's self-funding. So usually she collects anywhere from $50 to $100 a week, and that not only buys the food, but the pots and pans and the forks and knives that inevitably need to be replaced. And so some people, if most people gave $5, they would self-fund it, but some people give $20 and some people give $0. So it's completely on a donation basis, and we always have enough to fund our meals together. We do take a summer sabbatical, so everyone's excited right now, September, October, to have our meals again. And then we encourage endless sharing of meals in each other's homes. So the practice of hospitality, and we really, really have to coach our white members. Even though, because of the socioeconomic reality, our white members live in better homes, our white members also tend to be more professionistic. And the idea of hosting someone is so burdensome to some people. Like, oh my gosh, I got to clean everything. I got to cook everything right. I got to do this. And that's just not how we understand hospitality in many of our cultures, right? Your house must always be open. Native Americans understand this very well. Your house must always be open, whether it's clean or dirty or what. You must always have an extra space in your table, be able to pull up a chair. You should always have a folding chair right near your dining room table. Anybody nearby, just pull them in, and they should be able to have a meal with you. Even if everybody has to eat a little bit less, it's okay, right? There's always must be extra space for people to share a meal. So we try to practice this, model this, invite people into each other's homes. Pastor David, who's a native of Kenya, says where he's from in East Africa, there's a saying, you don't know somebody until you've been to their home and eaten with them. So we do this on a regular basis. And then next thing you know, people start wanting to live with each other. It is more cost efficient. But church members living together is like doing church every day. So it's completely incidental. But we now have about 10 community houses that our church manages. And we've had some conversations with people that are doing intentional community or the new monastic movement. As far as we know right now, there's not that many experiments where a local congregation is the hub of community housing. But one of the benefits of that is, well, first of all, the church itself doesn't own any property. We basically deal with the OS, the operating system of these community houses. So most of these houses are owned by regular church members, but they open it up. But if they sign on to community housing, they cannot act like landlords. If they want to have a landlord relationship, then they can do that, but it won't be counted as the formal Church One Nations community housing arrangement. So we have more people living together like that, but it's these 10 that are the formal part of CAN community housing. And that means that they have to accept our ethos. We don't really call it rules and regulations because that changes all the time, but our ethos. And that is like, first of all, you can't think like an owner. Owner of what? What do human beings own? The concept of ownership itself is an imperial construct and an idolatry. And also, what does it mean to own anything in America? Everything was stolen from Native people by hook and by crook. What does it mean that we're a law-abiding society? What a lie. Treaty law is law. The treaty law we have with European nations, NATO is treaty law. That's serious stuff. You know, there's hardly any law more important than international law, because you break that and you have war. And the 400 plus formal treaties we've signed with Native Americans, every single one of them was violated and not honored. And even so many of those laws were exploitative, right? Just touch the pen kind of thing. So even as exploitative and lopsided as those treaty laws were, even that was violated. That's the kind of context we live in. So to have the mentality of ownership is itself something we would have to challenge before anyone could participate in this, right? So Schultz-Jacksons, like Rebecca and her husband, Daniel Schultz-Jackson, live with the Daniel and Kendra Perez and rented from the Perez's. But we call it the PSJ house, Perez Schultz Jackson house. Right? And then now they moved two houses down, so they live in their own home, and they're all preparing for extended community housing. But when we give these houses a name, and it's not the name of the technical owner, it gets a new name, and the people have an equal share in that community housing. So for like rewiring the brain about who's in charge and who's not in charge and who gets their way and things like that is part of what it means to be included in our community housing. And who manages that? Well, myself, I kind of serve as a chaplain to these houses, and Dana, our pastoral assistant, does a lot of the housekeeping of it. We always have a waiting list, and then we try to fit people into different things. And we have different intensity levels and then lifestyle levels. Like, some people are couples and some people are single people, and some people live in this geographic area and do this kind of work and other people don't. Right now, Chatham House has 5 people living there, and they produce a surplus, meaning they more than cover the mortgage on that house. And the surplus is actually going to the Fink House, which is 4 houses away here, because we're doing massive construction, transforming house built in 1948, 1 bedroom, 1 bath, 840 square feet, to a 7 bedroom, 4 bath house. Jay and Tevin are staying at the Fink House right now. And a 1 bedroom, 1 bath house now has 8 occupants, and is the seminary house. Funded some by the students, their monthly rent, but the residents who live there, and then the surplus that comes from the Chatham House. Right. And even at the Chatham House, there's 5 people that live there, and there's 3 different rent levels. Because we take their income and their debt all into consideration, and so they all pay different amounts. And then that house's overall income level is compared to another house's income level, and then we try to make things equitable. So the people themselves don't have to argue about anything. They don't have to be jealous because somebody else outside is kind of managing that. So it's not like it's not a top-down kind of thing. We have discussions with everybody. But the discussions are led by and mediated by church leaders, which is why they're considered community homes. So the great thing about this arrangement is that some houses spring up and other houses disband. But the community housing itself continues through the congregation. And so so many intentional community homes that we know of are just one house. So any major lifestyle change or conflict or scandal or whatever means that the whole thing ends. So for us, all our community houses revolve around the central life of the congregation. There's so many other things that I could talk about, but let me just open it up to some things that that you're thinking about. I do hope that we will explore a little more among us about the kind of healing that we need at the molecular level. And I'll just say before we open it up that we really, as I said last night, have not figured out how to do this yet. We're kind of doing all these experimental things. We're even launching some for-profit businesses like the K-Mama hot sauce business that we hope will be the next sriracha on every restaurant table and in every home. Some of those profits will come to the church and to the seminary. So we're looking at alternate ways of financing our ministries, not just people's tithes and offerings. And there's so many other things that we're thinking about doing. But really, I find the single greatest challenge healing the imperial brokenness in our white members, not because that's just one more form of white privilege, which it could sound like, right? But because, as I said, white bodies are the most broken by empire. So if we can see healing at the molecular level in white bodies, that is hope. It's like canary in the coal mine. If we can somehow, through the power of the Holy Spirit, experience that in our midst, that means there is going to be hope for the rest of humanity, in my opinion. My home country of Korea is so fast, headlong going into neoliberal imperial ways. So that the need for healing is important and necessary and urgent all over the world. And we need to figure out not just, mental awareness and, intellectual radical commitment, but transformation at the bodily level. And how do we know whether we've been healed at the molecular level? When we are not anxious anymore, right? How does one know when we're not anxious if we've been anxious our whole lives? It helps to be in a multicultural church, right? If you're with other anxious people all the time, then we wouldn't know what it is. But when you actually are with non-anxious people, then you know. And if we can drain imperial anxiety out of our bodies, then I think that will be a pretty visible sign that there's been some significant healing in our lives. Questions or comments? JD?
Oh, so when I was writing my thesis, I was talking to one of my professors who is really progressive in his thinking. Even though he's Lutheran, he's very progressive in his thinking. No, Steve Hawson. So we were talking about the power of the gospel. Except all it is a seminary, we talked about the power of the gospel. And he said to me, well, J.D., if the power of the gospel could do that, it would have been done. The gospel has been here how many years?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that was one of the most disappointing answers I've ever heard. So other than the power of the gospel, is there any research that you know of, any scholarship, or have you thought about doing any of that yourself?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about that.
Sounds disembodied.
Yeah. I really do think there should be research on this. But how does one do research on something one is not aware of? And the research community is basically white people. Mm-hmm. And white people are not awakened to their own brokenness, mm-hmm. this imperial brokenness that we talk of. And though those of us who are not white are just busy living, and so I do think like awakened white people will need to do research on themselves in this area. I do think it's it would be worthwhile to do research here.
Yeah, I think so.
There are indigenous research methodologies that are really powerful. And I did my doctoral work in northern Minnesota doing qualitative research. And we met here a few months ago with Bob Tubols and a number of folks from the Episcopal Church. And what the Department of Indian Work did is they helped me develop a protocol of questions from indigenous mindset and going into a community where trust is hard to come to and listening. And then after doing research, asking that person, is there somebody else I should be talking to about this? Mm.
But are the research subjects white?
No.
Well, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
That's where we need the research. So I think that methodology could be very helpful, but I don't know of research that's being done on white people in this area.
So I hear a lot of like awakening in the individual in this, but also then wondering, and I don't think one comes before another. Always, I mean, obviously there is a rule about that, I'm racking my brain as I imagine planting a new community in Northeast. So we'll have to talk because we're going to be
okay.
That tied to place piece, and what is Can experiencing about that being tied to a place, and especially as that awakening is happening within individuals and.
Excellent question. Oh yes, CAN is short for Church of All Nations. Yes, forget sometimes. Church of All Nations came out of the Korean Presbyterian Church of Minnesota, which is just 5 miles from here. It's the historic immigrant church here in the Twin Cities, and most of our members that launched Church of All Nations were Korean. So it's a Korean-based multicultural church. Even though right now, Korean people would be about 17 or 18% of our adult membership. And only like 1 out of 6 of our elders is Korean. But like I said earlier, the ethos and the spirit, I would say, a lot of people would say, is still very Korean. As colonized as we've been by other powers, we've still been in one place for 5,000 years. So Korean people have a deep, deep rootedness, and we can still physically visit that place. Just this past March, my whole family visited our ancestral home, and we have a grave site that goes back 6 generations at least, and we have stories passed on of my family on my father's side, especially, that goes back to 600 AD. So even though we're here, and my daughter, who is learning Korean at the University of Minnesota right now, and mining that history through that, is developing a consciousness of her Koreanness, and when we visit Korea, she wants to visit that place again, this time with greater awareness. So there is something that we feel a rootedness. No matter where we are in the United States, we know where we come from, and we know we have access to that place. We're trying to figure out how to do that here on indigenous land, and how to do that as a community in deep, respectful, invitational relationality. And that's really challenging. But I do think... one of the ways that Korean people are kind of a middle people when it comes to empire is that we know empire very well, but we ourselves haven't been an empire. We've just been a subject of empire, much like the Jewish people. And they did have their own internal monarchy for several hundred years, and Korean people have had that too. But mostly those monarchies are pale in comparison to the great empires around them. Korean people have a tremendous sense of affinity with the Old Testament because it so mirrors our own history. So we feel like we know the language of empire pretty well, but we embody the downside of empire, not the upside of it. So we there's a part of us that wants to get ahead in empire, but there's also part of us that resists it at the same time because of our particular history. So we're trying to. I think we, those of us with a Korean background and embody Korean spirit, are trying to be people that can converse both ways. Like we can really we feel like we have some resources in our history to converse with indigenous peoples in this country and around the world. But we also know empire pretty well and can also converse with those that have been steeped in empire and be in the same room in conversation and move it forward. One of the reasons that I have hope for that project is because I've noticed that that Asian Americans bring a different angle to race dialogue, right? Because we are both subjects of racism and also the perpetrators of racism, because we have advantage compared to darker skinned people. And we live in a white supremacist society, so white people don't immediately find us threatening because our role has been to be the silent minority. So when we speak, we get a hearing just because we're not seen as threatening. But, you know, many, many white people have already shut their ears to the black voice. So there's a kind of we have a small window of subversive action that we Asian Americans can take if we understand the moment. So we see some opportunity for deepening of dialogue out of the Asian American, especially Korean perspective.
No, go for it.
I was thinking about some of the years I spent in Portland and, you know, Christian communities coming together, visioning for cooperative, revitalizing communities, and maybe even some conversation about living in community. And so it was exciting to be a part of the visioning process, but then, you know, when it came down to, like, actually getting in and saying, hey, let's live together, let's really, like, study together and have a deep commitment, there wasn't a lot of people jumping on board or I'm curious to hear a little more about the roots of how the intentional community started. Clearly, you know, 10 intentional communities doesn't just happen overnight. And I'm curious, what were the seeds that were planted that allowed it to grow? Mm-hmm.
Well, it was first a few women, recently graduated from college, working low-paying jobs, having to pay off huge amounts of debt, college debt, that decided to live together. And it was just kind of an independent thing. But when there were issues with money or some interpersonal conflict, they would come to me because I was pastor to all four of them. And that just natural pastoral leadership helped shape that house. And we call it the girls' house, our earliest modern, that was only about a mile from here. And then some of them left and formed another community, and then it began to just evolve naturally out of that model. But, I mean, this community, how do I say this? Basically, we have kind of an Asian patriarchal family structure here in this church. And I know that's going to set off all kinds of alarm bells, but patriarchy, as I understand it in the Korean context, there's definitely a sexist element that is not okay, of course. But I'm talking about patriarchy as a respect of the generations, respect for the elders. When I was growing up, my parents struggled tremendously in this country to make it. They used to be teachers in Korea, and they were working in factories in South Carolina, and they were gone a lot just trying to, you know, feed us. And they always said, you know, when we're gone, your older brother, my older brother is 4 years older than me, I have a younger sister is 3 years younger. He said, your older brother is mother and father to you, right? When we're gone, he is your parent. And then if older brother's gone, then I'm the parent to my younger sister. So that's what patriarchy means. It means paternal, maternal responsibility for one another at the level of survival. So there's a that's why we respect our elders. And because the elders have care for us at the survival level. My suspicion after all these years of ministry is that this radical individualism that we embody in America just basically means separation, premature separation, and separation anxiety and attachment disorder in most people. And so many people need to be reparented. And my wife and I are both Korean. My wife was born in the United States, but we were both Korean heritage. And so we ourselves give respect to our elders, and we behave like little children to those in the older generation. Like when we meet people, and they could be white, they could be black, they could be Asian, they could be anybody. When we meet people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, we reduce our posture and receive their authority and their care and love like children. And then we also naturally embody that for those in our care. And as a pastor, we kind of have a patriarchal, matriarchal role in this church. We're like parents to the whole congregation. And there's some people who might resist that, but people who sign up for church appointments just basically sign up for that. And so we have the function of reparenting many, many people in the congregation. That is, we are self-differentiated people, which means we are firmly who we are. When you're firmly who you are, you don't need to be coercive. Coercion and authoritarianism is always a sign of immaturity and insecurity. So people experience firmness and authority without authoritarianism. And that's the kind of parenting that, frankly, most people that we know of here have never experienced. Right? They've experienced like loosey-goosey parenting. You decide everything. It's your choice. You have to make up your mind about every little thing. Or a pretty harsh authoritarianism, a reward-punishment system. You're good or you're bad kind of thing. So there's a whole different kind of authority that functions here. And it has been healing, reparenting, an experience of a non-anxious family system. We're very much indebted to the Bowen family system theory, especially Edwin Friedman's work, Generation to Generation, and other things that he's written. So we're very conscious of having a low anxiety, differentiated, healthily individuated type of leadership and functioning here. And we do take some risks and allow for some codependence to arise, because some people, that's just the way they have to be. That's the toughest phase for me. And earlier in my career, I rejected it outright. I know what codependence looks like, and I rejected it outright. But that just meant no one could attach in the first place. So I've had to be a little bit flexible, like water, and allow for a little bit of temporary codependence with me as a pastor or my wife or other leaders, as long as we're in conversation and help people move out of that to healthy differentiation. That way of understanding the congregation as sheep, as children, what I would consider a healthy paternal stance is possible because I'm Korean. And the strange thing is, it's our younger white folks, like our millennial white folks, that are who have wanted it and demanded it the most. Right? So we've had to just live into that best we can, because the need for reparenting is so deep and so desperate. So that's part of our journey, a part of our experience, part of our strategy. Just remember, we're 12 years old as a congregation. All this stuff could fall apart. But so far, this is a need that we discern and a need that we're trying to address best we can. Grace?
I'm going to push back on you a little, so get ready.
I knew it.
So if we're using empire as like an umbrella term, it seems to me that the ways we've been talking about it so far at this conference specifically pertain to like whiteness and race, or and like the white supremacy, etc. And then however that becomes a thing in like an environmental and ecological crisis. But what seems to be lacking to me is like you used the word misogyny, so I was like, oh, that's something I've been thinking about. Just about misogyny and sexism and how that's like such like an insidious part of empire that I feel like I experience every day, along with racism. And I haven't heard a lot of concrete ways that we've discussed about how specifically the men in these spaces, or people socialized as men, are trying to heal from that. And you're talking about patriarchy in terms of like authority, which I'm also Korean and I get that. But like patriarchy to me is that when people walked into this room and there weren't chairs, I watched a bunch of women jump up to sit on the floor. And that there are no men sitting on the floor right now. And we in this space can think that we're all like doing a good we're all doing good things and that we're all enlightened and radical. But that's like that was like such a visceral presence of empire within all of us right now. So like to add another dimension to that, and you can just talk about that if you want to, or we can talk about that together, but to muddy the waters also, the ways in which, like, just talking about men and women in general, or, like, how we're opening this space to people of all different gender identities, especially non-binary people. Because I haven't heard, like, much of a queer perspective either, which I think is very important to me and important to people of my generation, I think. Because, I think heteropatriarchy or heterosexism or transmisogyny is also a part of empire that needs to be addressed. And I think, gender identity and gender expression and the way that we perform that in the world and move through spaces, even if we're saying, like, incredible things about liberating ourselves from neoliberalism and, like, the economy, and we're still incarnating, super entrenched gender roles, That needs to be named.
Amen.
Preach.
Yes. And yes. Good.
You don't have to go on the answer to the group.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's true. But I would like to address some of that. Why are we talking so much about white stuff at Church Foundation? It's a church that was 90% Korean 11 and a half years ago when we founded it. We've tried everything possible. We first started talking about multiculturalism, and then diversity, and then anti-racism, and then we used the term white privilege, which was really edgy, let me tell you, in the mid-2000s, okay? We think it's really mild now. And then in the late 2000s, we started to use the term white supremacy in our formal discourse, and that was really risky in those days. No matter what we did, white people kept coming, right? You can laugh at that. And like I said, we wondered in the first 2-3 years if we would ever have white people. So few joined in those years. But now we've, in the last 2 years, become a majority white church. And it's because of that. It's because white people join that we have to wrestle seriously with the brokenness of white people. Because that's our family right now. These are not them. This is our family. When are we going to deal seriously and deeply with LGBTQ issues? On the one hand, we have to be open to that. And actually, we have declared publicly that we will be open to that years ago. But when we will deal seriously and deeply with that is when people are part of the family. And because we make family work. But we don't do an issue abstractly first, and then hope that people join in on the issue. People just have to trust that this is a family where they can be themselves, and that the family will flex to be family together. And we have to stick it out with the new people, and the new people have to stick it out with us, and wrestle, and weep, and laugh, and hurt, and break things, and then restore them. And that's how we deal with issues here. But we don't take any issue, however urgent it is in the rest of society, if it is not part of our immediate family dynamic, then we'll just be pro something in abstraction. But we're pro our family. And because of that, when we come to, when we have a commitment in that issue, it's because that person led us to it. It's because we're pro that person that led us to be pro whatever that person ideologically or issue-wise or theologically represents.
Can I just say, the first thing that Grace talked about was misogyny. And at least that's what I heard first here you talked about. And gender roles. And it would seem to me that every community, and I'm not part of this community, but I'm guessing that could have tinged this community. I know it tinges ours. And so I'm not sure that's one we can avoid. And I don't have any grand thing to say about that, but
thank you.
I heard you avoiding
that. Well, what I would say...
I just forgot.
Okay.
I think you used a really good example earlier, Jen, about race. It's like, how can white people talk about racism when they don't know that they have a race? Mm. How can straight people talk about LGBTQ issues when they don't know that they have a gender identity?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, you do all have gender identities. Everyone in this room does. Whether it's been, like, brought to your attention because it hasn't been under duress is another thing. But, I don't know. I think the Church of All Nations is under a microscope right now because that's what we're talking about. But
yeah.
I would commend to you all as part of this movement that just because you don't think you have a gender identity doesn't mean that you don't have to talk about it.
And I will say, honestly, we're very underdeveloped in our gender and LGBTQ discussion. That's where we are. But we also are not anxious about it. We have seen our capacity to enter into deep discussion and metanoia when we have been led by our own members. And so we have hope that we're going to get there wherever we need to be.
Cool. I want to try to bring a couple of these threads together because I think everything that Grace named and we're talking about, I mean, in my experience, and I'm out myself, I'm a genderqueer transgender person. I have the experience of crossing. I have was socialized as a woman, if that's an ideology that we're using. And I have the experience everywhere I go of people not knowing what pronouns used to me or where to go to the bathroom and be safe. And my experience as a transmasculine person is largely privileged in comparison to the experience of trans feminine people, particularly people who are in that spectrum and are of color. So, to name that, so much of what Grace has named, homophobia, transmisogyny, comes back to misogyny, right? It's an idea, if we're talking dualism, that there are oppositional sexes, and because we're humans, when we have two things, one is on top of the other, now the two genders or sexes can't ever touch, and so we end up with gender roles, and so people who cross them, whether that's through sexual orientation in a way that men love men or like women, it's misogyny when we have a reaction to that. It's so much couched in misogyny. And I will say that as a trans person, like, I'm actually realizing now, like, 8 years into my transition, or longer, depending on how we're talking, I'm realizing how much white supremacy and white rhetoric and the idea of quantification has made it difficult for me to even name myself.
Right.
Wow. You know? And so, we can talk about terms, and I'm about to give a workshop next week for some youth ministers about how to make safe spaces for transgender youth, and I just kind of want to be like, I don't even know what a transgender youth is. And also, yeah. Gender identity and expression are concepts that don't have really any meaning. Just be nice to people. And if someone comes to you and says, I would like to be called Lightbulb today, you're like, that's great. Moving on. Anybody else? Anyway. So, shifting it to asking ourselves, for me, the experience has been so much an experience of God calling me into a gendered vocation. And like Grace said, we all have gender identities. Mm-hmm. So, like, if we're going to grapple with this kind of supremacy, like, we all have to grapple with our gendered vocations.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
And not let them be handed to us by an empire.
Sure. Amen. Wow. Thank you.
Likewise.
Well said.
Isn't it a really similar thing to how, you know, white people are hurt in ways we don't know that we're hurting? That people who are cisgender or who are straight don't know the ways in which your own, you know, fear of what is other than you has held you from something. It's the exact same conversation, and often with the same characters in play.
Just an interesting observation about my home country again. We're having to deal with, like, modern American-type sexism issues now in Korea because of the industrialization and everybody falling into the neoliberal economy. One of the reasons why we haven't, like, really had feminist movements, even though men have kind of been in charge of Korean society, is because of our family-based structure. And I find so much in common with Native American family structures. The home was considered the most important place. And women ran the homes. My mom, it doesn't matter how much money my dad made or whatever, my mom controlled the purse, the investment, the spending, the how to spend on the kids, whatever expenses. So the Korean women that I know, it's like they patronize the men. So, okay, you can have the credit and you can have the name, you know, you can have the applause, but we're going to run the most important thing, and that's the home. So in America, it's like being a homemaker is, you know, kind of low or something you have to do for a while to have children or something. But still in many parts of the world, the home is the most important part of one's identity and sociality. And so it was in the women's interest that the men go out and work and bring home whatever, and they would manage it. So there's just but now that women are working in the workforce, and when they're treated, you know, second class there, now we have serious issues. So there have been some, like, serious misunderstanding and even conflict at, like, World Council of Churches dialogue level when Western feminists would talk about the oppression of, you know, women in other cultures and not understanding this ancient arrangement and who really has the power, like who senses that where the power lies. So this is another interesting angle on this conversation.
Do we have time for more questions?
Yep, we have 3 more minutes.
Brilliant. I wonder what you think in general, having an experience of a very multicultural worshiping community here, what you see in other multicultural worshiping communities. You know, do you see some that are working differently than this, that are working well, and some that are going down dangerous paths?
Well, here in the Twin Cities, we have kind of a sister church relationship with Sanctuary Covenant Church. They're part of the ECC, headquartered in Chicago. I think, like, Swedish Covenant is their background. And Ephraim was a very good friend of mine, Ephraim Smith, and he intended the church to be founded in North Minneapolis and to have it big and to have an immediate impact on the politics and the economics, the education, the housing, everything in that area. So I think they've done their mission very well and very effectively. And that's something that that community desperately needed, an overarching sociological and political impact in that area. So I think, you know, different kinds of models can work very well. I'm not sure that there are that many that are doing it our way, which is family based, and it does require that Sumbek and I, my wife and I, have a healthy family. So that's part of the thing, and I don't know what would happen if our marriage fell apart when we were so family based, and this whole congregation is an extension of familial ties and love and commitment and all that. So we get that. I'm not sure.
Right. I wonder about, like, I'm Lutheran. You see Lutheran churches with white pastors in very diverse neighborhoods who are saying, we've got to look like our neighborhood, and how. And I see that, you know, possibly getting really complicated. Mm. Or not having good resources to do that in a way that's healthy. Perhaps because, you know, the white historical people in that congregation, the white leaders, aren't doing the work to heal themselves first.
Heaven, at one time, I'm at First Covenant now, but haven't been at Sanctuary for a few years. But also going back to the seminary thing with the Lutheran, I have to say this, Pastor Janet, I haven't been educated by the Lutheran Church for 5 years. I just don't. White people just don't see. I mean, I think Lutheran pastors mean well, but you can't see what you don't see. Mm-hmm. And outside of relationship and community, I wish I didn't see so much. Mm-hmm. But my white friends, I mean, I'm always like, can we just talk about the food on the table and not why I'm black and why I like it? It just gets draining. It does. And especially, it's so, and then I just felt the Holy Spirit calling me to go to this white church, which is Don John Adams. Mm-hmm. And I love the pastor there. He is awesome. But he admits, sometimes when he's talking to me, you know, JD, I just don't see. I can't see. Like my grandmother used to always say to me, she used to say to the family, all of us are where, all of us come from where we are from. Mm-hmm. So if white people don't, if we don't live in community, I don't know who live in your houses. I don't know if all white people live together and all the eight Koreans live together. I don't know how to do that.
It's kind of diverse.
But if outside of community, outside of community, we can't do this.
Amen.
If I just talk to my black friends all the time, we talk about food and clothes, but if white people don't, if we don't do this, I mean really do this, I'm sorry, y'all, you just won't wake up.
Amen.
Even with the trans thing. So I'm at the white church. I know we got to go. So I'm at this white church where people are married and the pastor, you know, well, he's been, because the covenant church doesn't embrace same sex. Mm-hmm. So the church kind of fell apart and, you know, over this issue. And I'm like, all the couples at the church are married. Like, I don't know where black folks go to get married. I don't know. But it all goes back to whiteness. I know that because I live in a white world. Mm-hmm. I know this. But I don't know.
Yeah. This is one of the reasons.
All white people can come moving out.
JD, thank you for that. It's one of the reasons why we haven't, we've been somewhat circumspect and cautious around LGBTQ issues. One way of looking at the history of white supremacy in America is groups of European descendants agitating for the full benefits of white privilege, right? You know that one of our founding fathers said that America is going to be ruined if certain kind of Europeans keep coming here. And among them, he mentioned Swedes and Germans. And this is Benjamin Franklin. And then we know of, many of you may be aware of the famous Supreme Court case, was it in the 1840s or 50s, that allowed Irish people to be considered white. There's a whole book written on that, how the Irish became white. And then Italians became white, and that was really problematic because it was more southern Italians rather than northern Italians. That means they mixed with the Moors, the Muslims in centuries past. And then even Jews became white. The feminist movement is women becoming white male. There's a brilliant essay written by a professor from Union Seminary called What Sex Is My Race? Who she argues that to be black is to be female in America, and that the male can...
James Bond was saying the same thing.
Would you have said that? Yeah, that the male domination of the female is the same thing as human domination of nature, and white domination of black, so that sexism is really the sin in America. Sexism is the sin, and black people were just feminized. And then some of us have seen that the last group of white people not to have the full knapsack of white privilege, as they say, are LGBTQ people. And we have seen amazing advances in that group, while black people are still getting killed willy-nilly all over the country. So please do not hear this as pitting one against the other. Both have to progress. Everyone has to progress. But that in our national consciousness, the kind of power that white people have, like when white people want something done, it usually gets done. When any group of white people want some things to be accomplished, it usually gets accomplished earlier and more effectively and more thoroughly than any other group's agitation. Think about Native Americans and African Americans and others. So we also have that view. And we have immigrants in this church. We have Native people and African Americans in this church. And to have, you know... a rainbow flag flying, if that stands for the liberation of any oppressed, I mean, of LGBTQ oppressed people, of course, but it can also look like one more privileging of a group of white people, right? So it's not that there aren't LGBTQ African Americans and Native Americans and Asian Americans, there certainly are, but the greatest point of oppression for people of color is their color. More than other points of oppression. So it's a very complicated thing, and that's why we have to have people in our congregation where we're not of the face of an issue, but part of the family. And that's how we have dealt with issues before. I mean, you know, the stuff that you've heard me say last night and here, this is stuff I say from our pulpit every Sunday. How do you think people can handle this unless we were family? We're not issues. We're not all representing different, you know, issues and preferences and urgencies. We're family. So this too, this issue too, is going to be have to happen as part of a family meeting. You know, hey, one of us is like this or that, and okay, and what kind of family meeting do we need to have to get through this? How do we be family through this? Anyway, thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Let's eat some more food. And I hope some of you can make it to the bonfire.